BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
Hello, this is James Naughty. Thank you very much for downloading this edition of Book Club from BBC Radio 4. Hello and welcome to Book Club, once again this month bringing author and readers together from a distance. We are delighted to welcome Max Porter to talk about his novel Lanny, which was longlisted for the Booker Prize and which has had an intoxicating effect on so many readers. It's the haunting story of a young boy, he's about 10, who's trying to make sense of the world in the English village where he lives, with his warring parents denying him a steady hand. A strange, spectral figure, dead Papa Toothwort, who lives in the woods, seems to offer him the emotional release and hope that he craves. The language is intense, Lanny's enclosed world often shimmers with menace, but for all the presence of the unexplained and the inexplicable, it never loses its grip as a story about a boy we come to know as a real character, whose troubles and desires we learn to share. Max Porter, from your home in Bath, welcome to Book Club.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Now, Lanny is a boy, Max, who keeps his distance, and he clearly finds the world in many ways a puzzle. I can't help feeling that in the rather strange predicament afflicting so many people in isolation of various kinds at the moment, he truly emerges as a child of our time.
Yeah, he is. And oddly, because he likes the outdoors, I think he'd be quite well equipped to deal with lockdown life. I think he'd quite like the kind of forced regimentality of it. I think he'd be quite good at setting himself daily tasks. I think he'd be incredibly crafty, papier-mâcheing and carving and collaging like mad and planting succulents and things. You know, it seems to work for a certain type of person. I think Lanny is one of them, yeah.
There is a paradox about Lanny, isn't there? Because although he's sensitive to everything going on around him, and in that sense is innocent as he discovers what's happening and has ideas about the other characters who surround him, he's also a rather mature figure.
I mean, you're right that he's about 10. I never age him, but I think that age when children still have the kind of imaginative freedoms of childhood and what we would conventionally describe as immaturity that goes with that, emotional perhaps, but also this weird ability to tune in to the philosophical and emotional currents of adulthood in a way that is startlingly mature or insightful when viewed as an adult. So he has a kind of weird accidental proto-environmentalism. He has a keen sense of social justice, but no idea, I don't think, of what social justice means in the world. I mean, all children have it, but at that particular age, you're almost straddling childhood, dealing with this burning curiosity to find out what's going on in adults' minds. And you see things morally in very straightforward terms. You're outraged. I mean, I remember certainly at that age, it was Boutros-Ghali held that first global conference about the environment. And I remember being charged up in a sort of Greta Thunberg, ineffectual in comparison, but charged up. You know, my school projects were all about the Amazon rainforest and poaching and species extermination. That all linked together to me to this general failing I perceived in the adult world. Why weren't adults doing more about this? And that's quite common, I think, in children.
It is a familiar feeling. And on that related theme, let's go to our first reader, Sarah Jackson, who has sent in this question.
In the story, you describe a child who perhaps doesn't always find it easy to fit in or be perceived as fitting in his school and community, and also an artist who has similar issues of a sense of belonging or recognition in his community. So I wonder, do you think that it's okay to be different?
That idea, Max, of difference is really at the heart of the book. Is it okay?
Yes, it's a book I hope that celebrates difference. I hope it's also is loving towards difference, but also seeks to look at the idea of otherness. I hope it rubbishes the idea of normal. And I don't think it needs celebrate eccentricity to do that, but it happens to because of the subjects it deals with, art and childhood and myth and imagination. But yeah, I hope it makes the idea of difference between us and a notional them seem a nonsense.
We should fill in a little bit of the background at this point, I think. Lanny and his parents, Jolie and Rob, have moved from London to a village, sort of commuter-belt village. And among the characters, I've mentioned the man in the forest, whom we'll come to later, but there's also a very important figure, the artist, Pete, who's known in the village, not surprisingly, it's the fate of many artists, as Mad Pete. And he is very, very important in the development of those urges that Lanny feels, isn't he?
Yeah, they have an informal and casually agreed upon pedagogical relationship. Pete agrees to teach Lanny art, despite his own misgivings about the idea that art can be taught. And he was a successful artist back in the day, and he enjoys Lanny's company, so he agrees to do these art lessons. And what happens is that they both discover in each other and in themselves an incredible love of the natural world, of observing things, and they become friends. And it's a very unlikely relationship in some respects. When I first wrote the relationship, I wrote it in response to what seemed to me, and I think has now proven to be, one of the most age-segregated societies, certainly in Europe. So the idea that an old man and a young boy would hang out together without that causing a sort of social scandal seemed highly unlikely, but also quite romantic. And also from an educational point of view, I believe we do things terribly wrongly in some respects in the way we grade and test our children very early on. And so I wanted a kind of escape for Lanny and for Pete from those strictures. And I just wanted it to be just a relationship in which the shared love of materials, of materiality, of surfaces, of textures, touch, of playing, basically. They're playing together.
Let me say that the book features narrations from many points of view. It's a sort of multifaceted view of the village and of Lanny and the people around him that we get. And I'm going to ask you to read from the novel now, Max. And this is in Pete's voice, Pete the artist. It's him that we hear there. Just tell us where we are. Set the scene.
This is the first part of Lanny. This is, as you say, from Pete, who I will identify by giving him a slight West Country accent. This is one of their art lessons, and this is where they discovered that they can go on these little jaunts, which now in lockdown life seems incredibly romantic, that you might meet someone from another household and go off into the woods with a couple of pads of paper and some pencils, but this is the life they're leading together. We stop by the Elvis Hare Hawthorn. This, Lanny, is a significant place. Why? This is the first point at which you can no longer be seen. The village is always watching, but past this point you're beyond their gaze. Either side of us woods, ahead of us hills, some very old trees round this way. We tramp down the steep-walled chalk and moss run, tree roots like sea monsters lining our route, and we discuss the passing of time. I tell Lanny about the ghost of Ben Hart, who runs up and down this track trying to find his beloved. Headless Ben Hart calling out for his girl. I'm only teasing, trying to shit him up a bit, but he replies in all sincerity, "Brilliant! I hope we meet him." We stop and draw the tangled lines of beach foundations under a stone. The boy does well with charcoal. He likes the way it smudges. "Making shadows," he says. Often as he works, Lanny says strange and wonderful things, mumblings, puzzling things for a child to say. "I'm a million cameras, even when I'm sleeping, clicking, clicking. Every second something is growing and changing. We are little arrogant flashes in a grand, magnificent scheme." I burst out laughing. "You what? Where did you get that from?" "Not sure," he says. He tilts his head and some half-formed secret thing skips out of his mouth and disappears into the space between us. Times like this, Lanny seems almost possessed.
Possessed in a world which is always on the move, changing, growing with different colours and different shapes. That is Lanny's world. I want to bring in now one of our listeners, readers, who's been listening to the conversation so far, Maura Chacko. Have you got a question?
Yeah, I do. And thanks so much for doing this. It's great to talk to you guys remotely. As you had mentioned earlier, we also watched Lanny from the perspective of dead Papa Toothwort, the ancient spirit who lives in the woods. And he feels both supernatural and real to me at the same time. And he sees and hears life in the village. Did you write him as a symbol of the natural world and its reaction to our impact on the environment?
Hi, Maura. That's an extremely interesting interpretation, and I like it, and I agree with it. And yes, to some extent I did. But one of the things I feel quite strongly about was that there should be multiple understandings open to the reader at any one time. Is he a metaphor for the natural world? Is he a daydream? Is he a symbol? Is he a joke? Is he a sort of manifestation of the relationship between Lanny and Pete, or whatever? I want all these interpretive pathways open to you. I never want to lock it down. The reason there's so much kind of blank space, literally, in the book is that I want that to be a kind of collaborative relationship between you and the text that is changing throughout. So at certain points in the book, for example, when he's a kind of voyeur that seems to represent the passing of the time, and at least to Lanny, seems to represent a ecological still point upon which the human enterprise tramples, then yeah, I think that reading is very helpful. Yeah.
We should explain a bit more, shouldn't we, about a dead Papa Toothwort here. I mean, how he is made out of different things. He seems almost mythological. He springs from the earth like some kind of green man, but he's also real in the sense that his impact is profound and, if you like, tangible.
And I think it is interesting. I loved the way what he hears in the village was written in the fluid script and different space and different writing, so that it really did feel ethereal, but again, felt real. And I appreciate that there's different ways to interpret it. So absolutely.
One of our readers, Paul Forty, has been in touch with this observation and question for you, Max.
I really like the magic realism, and it didn't feel whimsical at all in this book. I like the sort of the 21st century commuter belt preoccupations, the narrow-mindedness of the people in their own little bubbles and afraid of otherness in others such as Pete or Peggy or even Jolie. And I wondered if you could actually agree with the fact that it would be regarded as magic realism.
Yeah, I'm not especially enamoured of labels, but I definitely think it's relevant here. Or certainly, I'm not writing a social realist novel in any consistent way, but I hope I have a bit of that in the first part and I allow you to come with me into a more magic realist mode in the third part. I'm very indebted to children's books, so for me it's more the kind of freedom between modes that hybridity allows me. So I might borrow the techniques of a play, I might borrow the techniques of children's books or an essay or poetry. And ultimately, I hope I'd render more or less meaningless a label such as realist or magic realist, because ultimately it's just Dead Papa Toothwort. The freedom he has to move between shape, between form, is the same freedom he affords the text itself. But yeah, absolutely. I mean, I love magic realist literature, and I recognise that by starting the book on page one with a mythic character made of bin bags and condoms and bits of old bramble, that I'm certainly suspending so-called reality in many ways.
We should say, though, that the book isn't a dreamy meditation on things. It's a story. And there is a great drama at the centre of the story, which is the disappearance of Lanny. Now, we're not going to spoil it for people who have not yet read it. But the disappearance is central, and I think we can talk about that. It's the hinge on which everything turns, isn't it, Max?
Yes, it is, yeah. And it's not a spoiler to talk about it, I don't think. And I think the truth is that Lanny is always missing, even in part one, which is about him. He very rarely speaks, and he's very rarely the centre of the action. He's a sort of hole in the middle of the book, a kind of centrifugal absence around which everyone else defines themselves. So the fact of his actual disappearance in part two, I think you're prepared for that as a reader. And obviously because I remove conventional sort of backstory or the labelling of characters, so you're sort of plunged into a world where you're wondering whether you imagined Lanny or every possible idea of Lanny is contested. What did he look like? What was he like? Was he eccentric, or was he annoying, or was he sort of mystical, or was he a prat? You know, I want all this floating around. But the fundamental idea of the missing child, both actual in Lanny's case, but also kind of allegorically, the idea of all of our missing childhoods, I hope that's sort of announced, yeah, more or less immediately.
Well, Lee Henshaw is another of our readers, Max, who's been listening to this conversation. Lee, you dive in now.
Thanks, James. Hi, Max.
Hiya.
I think my favourite character in this book is Pete. I love Pete. And I think that kids Lanny's age need an influence like that. My question was about why he draws out the worst in the village, you know, the suspicion and the violence.
Well, thank you for your kind words, and I'm glad you like him. I love him, and he was really who the book started with, and I based him unashamedly on various people I've met and loved in my life, and to whom I'm grateful for their love and their time and their patience, and less their influence, because that sort of influence is sort of poisoned as an idea, isn't it, with fear and all sorts of things on the vertical axis, but certainly permission givers. For me, people that gave me permission to think, yeah, you can just make something and give it away, or you can just make something for the pure pleasure of pencil on paper or whatever it is. Thinking of art and its uses. But in answer to your question, why did the village treat him this way? I suppose I did want to write a little bit about what I perceive as a kind of dangerous anti, all sorts of things gather here, but anti-intellectualism, a certain degree of philistinism, the tendency we have in a relatively conservative cultural environment to label things pretentious, I think is terribly damaging to progression of ideas and sensibility. And I think art is incredibly important for any society. And the minute you start labeling it all dodgy or weird or pretentious, then you have no development, you have no avant-garde, and that's very dangerous. But also the sort of ways in which he's labeled mad or dangerous or bad, this is the language we use to other people. And I see it not just in small communities, but on a national scale and an international scale. The violence of the language particularly, and it all begins in language, of the way we speak of the other or those notionally different to ourselves, as I was saying earlier on. And there are also explicit reasons why people speak that way of Pete, is because he seems to threaten the security of the place by bringing in dangerous ideas. His work was famously in the 70s and 80s was about homosexual art, homosexual ideas, and he made some quite risky work, as it were, infamous work in the 70s and 80s. And so perhaps he threatens the kind of heteronormative so-called normality of the place. There's all sorts of ways in which he does that, and we don't really discover them until this moment of crisis, this moment of trauma in the second half. And I suppose it's a model village in that regard. And I wanted to say that any village, this is very specifically an English place, but I hope by being very specific, I've maybe got at something universal, which is how small degrees of suspicion or gossip flare into actual nastiness, or indeed bigotry, or indeed xenophobia on a bigger scale. And I wanted to make a model of that with Pete as my central object.
It's a very powerful observation and impulse, this, isn't it? I mean, you think of George Crabbe's poem The Village, which, you know, was famously set to music in the operatic stage by Benjamin Britten and Peter Grimes. This feeling of the village as an organism can turn nasty, can turn in on itself, has a kind of strange life at its heart that it's very, very difficult to understand, or, as you point out in this story, to predict.
Yeah, and one of my aims in the book is to kind of credit the reader with enough sophistication to be very familiar with the way that organism works, particularly in times of crisis. And that's why there's so little backstory. Same with the kind of police procedural aspects or the marriage plot. I know that my reader reads lots of novels and watches lots of TV and reads newspapers of different kinds, so I don't need to provide lots of backstory. I can give you the single pertinent sentence, for example, the crisis of faith. You're only going to hear that single sentence, and you might make a judgment on page 50 that's going to be challenged on page 150. So I hope that there's, as I say, this collaborative aspect whereby you're in the village with them, doing the misunderstanding or the judging or the hoping or the fearing, because you know enough about the way that human beings behave in these sorts of situations.
And of course, Ed Papatoothsworth is always listening. He hears everything. Mena Cominetti is another of our readers who sent in this question.
Hello, my name's Mena. I'm an art teacher from London. I wanted to ask about dialogue in the book, as it often appears as free-form verse. The words literally curl across the page. Those parts felt like echoes or overheard moments in conversation. So I was wondering what your relationship is to sound during the writing process.
Thanks, Mena. And you said you were an art teacher, which is obviously a heroic position, given what we're talking about. The fundamental thing for me was that he's a voyeur and this is overheard. He's floating underneath people's houses listening. So it had to appear on the page as something other than my prose. But I didn't want it to be a gimmick or too distracting. And I wanted people to actually read it. It would teach them to actually have a slightly more musical way of reading and almost achieve a kind of counterpoint between the body of the text, the story, the language in the novel, and the overheard stuff, almost as if they're listening to the radio while they're doing something else. And I hoped that the result of that would be a kind of hyper-attention to syntax, to the nuances of the way people speak about each other and themselves, so that in part two, when I remove everybody's names, you're listening incredibly carefully and you can identify people and you can see the ways in which their language makes them complicit or irrelevant to certain things that are happening. That was the fundamental aim of the way the text dances around. But I also want beauty on the page, and I want people to be reminded in a very bodily sense of what an extraordinary thing a novel is. You know, you are holding this thing in your hands, and the idea that you might have to go closer as their Papa Tutuwort's listening intensifies and this bad thing that's going to happen starts to happen. And you might actually have to change your position to the physical object. And I build my work from a poetic line or from a fragment. I draw and doodle and start with just maybe half a dozen words, which would appear to be something approaching poetry, and then I build up from there.
You're listening to Book Club on BBC Radio 4. We're talking about Lanny, a novel by Max Porter. Let's move now to Yelena, who has sent in a question about Lanny's name.
Hi, Max. My name is Yelena, and I wanted to ask you about Lanny's name. It's very special and affectionate, and feels core to his character. It's also the title of the book, which is what speaks to readers when they first see it on the bookshelves. So how did you choose it?
Weirdly, I wrote a sort of prose poem about Lanny and Pete many years ago, and it had no dead Papa Tutuwort, and it was really about a missing child. And I put it in the drawer and forgot about it for a long time. But the word Lanny at that time came out of some nonsense. I was very interested in nonsense verse, and I was trying to write a kind of musical non-language. And one of these pieces was about someone called Lanny Glastorgan, Green Tree, Green Tree. And they were kind of like Lanny's spell songs. And I don't know where the word Lanny came from, actually, but it stuck.
Well, let's go back to the character of Lanny and hear again from a reader, Paul, who asked one question earlier.
I was interested in the parents in this book. The father, commuter, feels absent, doesn't understand his son, and the mother is caught up in her own work. And they sort of let Lanny roam free, perhaps in a way that comes back to haunt them a bit later on. Would you consider the book to be something about a reflection on modern-day parenting techniques, perhaps?
Yes, I think it probably is a reflection on parenting, but I hope a sort of non-judgmental one, and I hope that by the end of part one you are enjoying the relationship between Pete and Lanny, and you realise what good is coming of it for both of them, and I hope for us, in a sort of shared enlightenment that comes from being in the woods with these nice people looking at trees. I mean, it's pleasing, and I hope therefore in part two you're thinking, gosh, the lapse of judgment, and maybe even feeling a tiny bit guilty that you were complicit in that lapse. But I also, you know, I'm a child of the 80s. We were allowed out. The world is very different. We were allowed out until it got dark, and we made our way home eventually on our BMXs and our skateboards, and we were often lost.
It should be said, I think, Max, that in the book, one of the undercurrents is that very difficult question about the relationship between children and adults, particularly strangers. But as you've just indicated in that last answer, the whole question has become much more troubled in recent years. I mean, that's clearly something that was in your mind, in the question that arises in the minds of the villagers.
Yeah, I think the proto-Lanny that I wrote many years ago that I was just referring to then, that was written during the kind of peak of Operation Yew Tree, which listeners will remember was this time of manic activity in the exposing of child abusers, but also led to a great deal of what in retrospect we can all see was deeply manipulative and unpleasant work by the British tabloids. And I think therefore there was a sort of escapism involved in the initial drawing of the relationship between Lanny and Pete, based perhaps on close relationships I had with non-family members when I was a child, and the kind of fear that those relationships would no longer be able to exist. The idea that I wouldn't be able to sit in a person's home and have them explain to me how charcoal works. All our relationships would need to be protected by institutional guidelines. The novel shouldn't be an essay on the subjects it encounters. I hope it's enough to plot these ideas on the page and have the reader run away with them. But certainly there are moments of genuine romantic, almost rhapsodic. And it's funny you mentioned Benjamin Britten there. Are these sort of overtures to friendship in Lanny, which were very, very romantic, almost sentimental. And I don't apologise for them because of the magic of those relationships, the influence they've had on me and my own children.
Well, Max, we're coming towards the end of the programme. I want to have one last question. And I repeat, we're not going to discuss the ending of the book in any detail. But Joyce has got a question that touches upon it.
There was a recurring theme in the book around the falseness of endings, or rather, all the potential futures that could be. Did you yourself have any trouble deciding where or how the book was going to end?
That's an interesting question, because I have a sort of official answer and an honest one. I'll give you the honest one. I planned to have 5 different endings, like a choose your own adventure book that many of us read when we were children. I thought that each of the main characters would have an ending, and I would ask the reader to decide which they liked, or to have all 5 or a couple of them sort of hovering in front of them as the ending that they leaned into emotionally or philosophically or whatever the case may be. And when it came to it, I felt that actually that would not be fair on the characters in the book, who now felt very real to me, and nor would it really be fair on the reader, because it would be the novelist jumping back in and going, ta-da, here's a thing I've done, which I think is clever, and I didn't want to be anywhere near it. I wanted to be absent, and I certainly didn't want to be doing something which might risk the pitfalls of gimmickry. So I just went with what I felt was the truest and fairest way of ending the book. And then also, there was a character in the book called Peggy, and I came to love what Peggy represents, a kind of old maternal wisdom. If there is such thing as a sort of deep English folkloric wisdom, then I hope she represented it. And I wanted to give Peggy a cameo in the end of the book. So she kind of took over and said, this is how it's going to be. And I always listened to bossy older women in my life. So I thought, yes, Peggy's in charge now. And I let her finish the book in the way she told me she wanted to finish it. And I'd gone from being one of those people who didn't really believe it when writers said their characters speak back to them, to being someone wholly obedient and very much listening to what my characters were telling me to do.
And for readers who are joining us to hear about Lanny without having read it first, you'll have to find out for yourselves. It is worth it. Max Porter, thank you very much for being our guest on Book Club this month and for talking about Lanny. Thanks, of course, to all our audience of readers who took part in various different ways today. Remember, if you do want to join us at one of these recordings, we hope to be back in the studio soon, you can find all the details on the Book Club website. Next month, on the first Sunday of July, that's the 5th of the month, our guest will be one of the best-selling American thriller writers, Scott Turow. We'll be talking about the novel that started it all, his first legal thriller, Presumed Innocent. If by chance you haven't read it, it is a guaranteed page-turner. Now, this is the moment when we normally hear a big round of applause from our readers gathered around us in the studio. We can't hear that today, but we very much hope to have you all around us again soon. From me and from Book Club, do keep reading along with our choices. Until next month and the next book.